see Morgan at all.
Sarah, I think you can pull it down. Just put it in front of the...
I feel like I made myself a pillow fort.
Well, now I can see you.
Okay. We can at least see eyes.
Yeah.
And eyes are the windows to the soul. Peep. They might also give away if you're lying in a confession or not. Could they not?
Oh, Sarah, going right in.
I am. This is Sinister Sunrise. I'm Sarah.
I'm Morgan.
I'm Aaron.
And it's false confession time, aka group story.
Yes. So today we're giving no facts. We're going to lie the whole time. It is our false confession. That is my 16-year-old album name. No, that was Lizzie Erno. What's her name? Not Lizzie McGuire. Hillary Duff.
Okay.
God-given name. Well, it's not. It's her stage name. That was her album when we were like in high school.
What
Confessions,
album?
Right?
Oh, yeah. She sang. I saw her perform at...
No. I knew she sang. I just don't know the name of the album.
I think it was Confessions.
Let the rain fall down. That's the one.
Wake my dreams, let it wash away my sanity. Don't get me wrong. Give me some Hillary Duff up in here. I think I know more Hillary Duff than I want to admit that I do.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like if a bop came on that wasn't coming clean or whatever the fuck, mm-hmm. I would know it.
Oh, I think it's Metamorphosis. It's
yeah,
not
that's
confession.
I was gonna Uh-oh. Say Metamorphosis. That's not, that's it. Where it's the teal background in her face.
See, I lied.
And she
False
wears
confession.
Those ripped
it's that easy
those ripped that ripped fabric outfit. Yeah, come on, kind of like Kelly Clarkson at the end from Justin to Kelly. That's a bop. You guys remember that movie?
I do. I remember seeing it.
He was not cute. His eyes are spooky. Sorry if you're listening, Justin.
There's Confessions by Usher. That's an album.
Well,
slightly different.
Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen.
All false. All what we're talking about today is, in case you haven't noticed, false confessions.
Bum, bum, mm-hmm. bum.
Lightning strikes.
A storm brewing. Deep within, a false confession. Well, instead of Sarah's doing Sarah's British accent, maybe I'll just read mine like a dramatic, like 1940s poet the whole time, like a Vincent Price. I'll read my whole story like that.
We should all get Today. Chase lounges then and listen to you just give this diatribe.
I could.
Yes.
I could.
Okay, pause the show. Pause it. Pause everything.
Oh, yeah. So we're just going to dive right in?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, because it could be, hey, buckle in, guys. It's a group episode. Erin messaged the group what her case was, but I didn't look at it. I did look to make sure it wasn't the same, and it was not, thank God.
Okay.
I knew Sarah was going to do the history and such, and I didn't even say what case I'm doing. So this is going to be raw and real, ladies and gentlemen. Raw and real.
Okay.
And with that, Sarah, take it
Very
away.
Tense.
Sarah, what is a false confession? Are you gonna What?
You didn't define it?
No.
Well, it's when you say something that isn't real in an interrogation room or to a cop, and then you probably go to prison. Basically, what you're saying you did a crime that you did not actually commit.
Yeah.
The first thing that comes up is, what is a falafel?
And usually through, like, coercive techniques are being used, right?
Yes. Okay.
Possibly.
A false confession is an involuntary statement of guilt made under duress or as the result of coercion. Jurors, judges, and prosecutors must be willing to accept the fact that under the right circumstances, just about anyone naive to the criminal justice system can be victimized into a false confession.
Confection.
Candy.
Confectionary delight.
Go to the library. Why not?
Uh-huh. I'll go right over to the library, Sarah.
So I will say the coercion. Okay. If you're looking at like false confessions throughout history, it's made a lot more sense up until recently because, yeah, throughout history, there is no laws against torture. So if someone's pulling out my nails, I too would say anything.
Sarah, of course you have to give that example.
Did you blow up that building? Yep. Are you a 6 foot tall Hispanic man living in Idaho? Sí, señor. You'll find out real quick. I fold. I don't want any of that.
Oh, my God.
But the United States and our Constitution included a very pertinent clause to help protect us against this.
Mm-hmm.
Are either of you familiar with the Eighth Amendment? I did include this because it is today America's birthday.
I mean, not off 4th of July. Head.
That's when we're recording.
Mm-hmm.
It does come out this week.
Mm-hmm.
So, America, I guess. Woohoo.
Patriotic test. Who knows it?
Not I. Something about... Okay, we got bear arms. Vote.
Yep.
8th Amendment. Double jury? Double jeopardy?
You have the right to an attorney. Anything you say is due.
That's the... I know.
Okay. Yeah. We are looking for the amendment that outlaws cruel and unusual punishments. Which goes for police as well.
Okay.
So if you were a citizen, you now get to keep your nails during investigations.
Mm.
To be fair, does that mean every single police force is following it to a T and everything is like butterflies and rainbows?
No.
No. But it should be a lot harder to do the things we used to do like in the 1600s.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm sure you'll get into it and maybe with both of our cases, but like you can do the punishment stuff. Like that's not going to stop a cop from doing their job, which is to try to catch guilty people.
Correct.
So they could be a little sneaky. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
What I'm saying is the level of torture in theory and what we videotape now is way, way less than what it used to be.
Yes.
So that begs the question of why do people still confess to crimes that they did not commit?
I don't know, Sarah. Why?
I didn't write that down either. So.
Oh, well, I'm going to say, I mean, you'll find out in mine real quick.
Same.
Okay. We will lead by example. We're going to hear some more background and then you'll find two examples of why.
At a minimum, she says. Okay. So it all starts in the interrogation room. Once you are in that room, you are presumed guilty and it's the job of the interrogator to get a confession from you. It's also the assumption of the interrogator that the guilty person would not be forthcoming with the truth. Which, to be fair, makes sense. Yeah. Ain't nobody trying to go to jail. So I can see how they would assume you're going to lie. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So it makes sense why those tactics are there. But they also mean you are going to presume an innocent person guilty. Mm. Like, it's in the numbers. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
But then you can accidentally break that person down using tactics like get in the person's face. Don't let them off the hook. Don't accept their denials. And urge them to really think about the consequences if they continue to not cooperate. You can be held in this room with someone attacking you with questions and assumptions for hours on end.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of false confession cases, I don't know if yours is the same, but the person in the interrogation room was in there for at least 16 hours.
Yeah.
Not my case, but yes. Aaron, I can't remember what case you said you're doing, but I did listen to a Anatomy of Murder. Oh, fuck. Was it Anatomy of Murder? I listen to a lot of podcasts on the way to work, guys. I'm pretty sure it was Anatomy of Murder this week. And the episode, the guy was in there for 20 hours over the course of 3 days. So, like, sometimes I've heard, like, they're, you know, you said 16 hours at a time. But, like, I can't, like, six one half dozen of another of, like, what's worse? 20 hours over 3 days or 16 of one, you know?
Yeah, like, straight.
Whew.
Yes, because it's not like they're playing smooth jazz and you have those case lounges. Maybe Morgan's speaking like, yeah, what were you going to say? The diatribe of what?
Oh, no, Vincent Price.
Vincent Price, yes, thank you.
That's the thriller guy.
We're getting ghost stories.
Darkness falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand.
And you could be going to prison.
I was telling you guys at brunch, but I stumbled upon this website where they're basically explaining how to build a new police station and like what the interrogation room specs should be.
Okay.
So they're saying at biggest, at smallest, it needs to be an 8x10 room. That's the best size. It comfortably seats 3 people max with nothing else in the room. So you want just a table and 3 chairs.
Mm-hmm.
They go into the fact that it should not have any windows in this room. There should be no way to basically have any thought outside of what's immediately in front of you.
No distractions.
No distractions. It should not be at the front of the building. You don't want anyone walking by.
Mm-hmm.
The door should be very, I forgot the words they use, like strict or jarring, but should in no means look like a jail cell. But you want to feel like you are in a cell.
Mm.
Okay.
They give... reasoning for both sides. I mean, it sounds a little bit like psychological torture, but I also get from their perspective, like, we don't want people walking by. We don't want any distractions. We want to get in and out. We want this person to like realize this is their only option. Talk to us or you're done.
I mean, fuck, let alone a stranger walking by, let alone like someone that could be confessing against you. Like, you don't even want them to know that they're there.
No, but the phrase I kept using was, you don't want this person to think about any of the outcomes after they tell you what they're going to tell you. Like, you don't want them to think about walking free. You don't want them to think about going to jail.
Like some deprivation.
Kind of.
Yeah.
It was actually strange the amount of psychology that went just into making the room.
That's crazy.
They gave specifications on, like, where the two-way mirror should be, if you can have one. Like, it should be at least 5 foot tall, and it needs to face the person being interrogated. But it has to be that tall so they can never see themselves in the mirror.
Apparently, oh, if they're sitting?
Yes. That's also distracting, I guess. They should not be able to see themselves while sitting.
Mm. Yeah. Give you a reason to, like, envision yourself being caught or not caught.
Yes. They also suggest the one table should really be to the side because you want to be able to see the entire person's body that you're interrogating.
Hmm.
Also, like, the table in between sometimes gives people, like, a mental shield, like, I don't know, like it puts a little barrier in between you and your interrogator. So maybe mm-hmm. you aren't as forthcoming as you would be if you're just looking straight on.
Yeah.
Like there's nowhere to hide, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oof. So, okay. Let's imagine you are in this room. You've had to pee for 3 hours. You're exhausted.
I'm dead. I'm already dead.
I know. You're exhausted. You're psychologically drained. Now consider the fact that police are allowed to lie about what evidence they have.
Mm-hmm.
They can tell you, we have 4 eyewitnesses and your fingerprints are all over the murder weapon and you even failed the polygraph, also called a lie detector. None of that has to be true, but you do not know that.
That's crazy.
Yes.
I mean, it's good for the bad guys, but that's crazy for someone like us that we could be. Like, they could think I did something bad and they're like, yeah, you failed the polygraph. And I'm like, what? What? And I'm going to crumble. I'm going to fold. Mm-hmm. Just like you said earlier, Sarah, I'm going to fold. There's no torture involved, but you were lying to me, so I'm going to fold. Crazy.
And it's probably very jarring to be in there, especially if you didn't do anything wrong. Can you imagine the shock of like, this feels very serious, feels very grave. There's no artwork on the walls. That was another thing they brought up. Like, no distractions, just
plain.
Basically, yeah. Well, the wall color should be pastel, like a doctor's office.
Hmm. I think it's funny that in TV shows, it's always like dark green, like green. Not a calming green.
Hmm. Sarah was saying. Okay, so yes, they have all this evidence against you. Us being rational, 15 hours ago, we could have said, we know eyewitness testimonies are not good. But again, you are 15 hours in. You are broken down and you're starting to make mental bargains in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, would this evidence convict me in court? Is it worth taking my chances and getting up to 100 years? Or can I make this person in front of me happy, get to use the restroom, and get a better deal? The whole time you can know you are innocent, but you can also know that our criminal justice system is not perfect. And did I mention your bladder is going to explode?
Yep.
Yeah.
You may also think to yourself, I can go confess now, go to the bathroom, and then forensics or an attorney will be able to prove later that I am innocent. This is a minor inconvenience, but technology will be able to prove that I'm not guilty. Now imagine this is the case for someone from a low-income area, someone whose family is known to the police, who doesn't have the education or coping skills needed to get through this. Or imagine you're an immigrant whose first language is not English. That would be terrifying. That's like my worst nightmare. Like, imagine if we went to Mexico, wound up in Mexican jail for some charge that wasn't about us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it's like, pastel walls. I'm still like, no hablo inglés.
Yeah.
I think I said I don't speak English.
You did. Yeah, correct. I think you meant no hablas español.
Which would make it worse. But I don't speak English.
Like, I can say, can I go to the bathroom, please? And milk. So,
you're going to have a great time. Did you commit this crime? Milk.
Leche.
Can someone help her? So imagine you're an immigrant. Our police can also threaten to deport you if you don't cooperate.
Yeah.
Or imagine you're an addict. It doesn't have to be like a hardcore drug addict. It could be cigarettes or caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is 16 hours. No sleep, no outside lighting. And there is an angry cop in front of you. it's going to push you to want that, whatever your addiction is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is, again, just one more thing working against you.
Sir, can I have a White Claw?
Not in here. Not until you confess.
Yeah. Just joking. Sorry.
It just sounds like the entire room is like if Chess met Saul in a movie.
Yeah. And but also there is the sorry if you bring this up, but it just made me think of it. Like there is the other side of that where they want people to be super comfortable. So they'll say, do you want a soda? Like, we can get you a Coke. Like, oh, what kind of cigarettes do you smoke? Like, we'll get you a pack. Like, that's a thing too.
Ooh, I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. It's more for like, we're just buddies trying to figure this out. Come on, man. Not, I know you did it. Fuck you. It's gotta, you, sometimes they have to build the rapport with the person.
Either one, I would be sweating bullets.
Yeah.
Which actually is perfect segue. So you can be in these situations, you can be mentally keeping your shit together, mm-hmm. and you're denying the charges, but you're also fidgeting, sweating, crying, exhibiting any other sign of nervousness or agitation. It does not mean that you are guilty, but the police may read it that way anyway.
Yep.
Which means the cop may then get more aggressive.
I mean, fuck, I'm a nervous Nelly. I'm screwed.
Just envisioning the room makes my heart like...
mm-hmm. Yes.
Which we know that stressed and scared people are far more likely to confess to something they did not do. Because again, at some point, it becomes very logical to get yourself out of that intense situation and hope that the justice system will take care of you in the end.
God.
Now, let's imagine you are a child or an intellectually impaired person.
Oh.
These two groups alone are very over-representative in false confessions.
Making murder.
They are much more likely to be led, much more likely to want to please an authority figure, and mm-hmm. less likely to think about the long-term effects of what they are saying. Did either of you happen to watch Making a Murderer?
It was...
I did.
I'm glad that led you there, because
Stephen
it also
Avery. It's like the one case where I know the details of what happened. Normally I'm like, oh yeah, that kind of sounds familiar. I soaked that shit up like it was my job. Fucking love that show.
Do you want to give a quick synopsis of the Stephen Avery and Brandon Dassey case?
Okay. So Stephen Avery is Brandon Dassey's uncle. And they happen to live, again, it's been a minute, so bear with me on the facts. They happen to live in two trailers very close by each other. There is a woman who comes to Stephen Avery's house because he is trying to sell a car. And she is there to take pictures of the car. And what's her name? Oh. I can't remember. A woman. Yeah, we need it. Right. So Teresa Hallback is coming to take pictures of this car to post online, or of the car just to sell. Well, she never leaves the property. And they're trying to figure out who killed her because they have very minimal clues. They found her bones in a fire pit, part of her bones. They found blood in one of the, in that car, found her hair and a bunch of crazy other things. Well, Brendan Dassey, Stephen Avery's nephew, who referenced 30 seconds ago, is a little mentally delayed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the right diagnosis, so I don't want to misspeak, but
he has some kind of mental impairment.
Can care for himself, totally fine. The kid's 16, mm-hmm. maybe younger. And they question him without his mom present for hours.
Oh no.
And he ends up confessing to the murder when he didn't do it. Well,
they show
to be determined, but
yeah, I mean, on the show Making a Murderer, what I do like is they showed a pretty good clip of the interrogation and you can see some of these tactics, mm-hmm. but it's more so of Morgan's where they're not being harsh, but they're like, all right, we want to help you. We know you guys committed this crime. The best way to get your life back to normal is just to work with us. Like,
you're so young. We can help you. Even if you have to serve time, it would be very minimal. You tell us everything that you and your uncle did and we will do our best to take care of you.
Here's the thing though. Brendan does try and say we didn't do it. No, you did. So what'd you do? And they keep leading him. And throughout the video you see, he will say, okay, so you handcuffed her and then what did you do? And Brendan will make something up. We cut her into pieces. And when he got it wrong, police would say, no, Brendan, that's not what you did. Try again. Mm-hmm. So you watch him just like, okay, like he keeps trying to please the police officer.
It's literally like, so did you take her to the right or to the left? And they're like, and he's like, the left? And they're like, correct. Exactly. That's what you did. Like, it's bad.
I mean, technically all of it's legal. They didn't coerce him, but like, these are why those mental impairments really matter, because you can see how much it does not connect with him, what he is admitting to, when at the end he asks if he can go back to class or back to watch some movie or something.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to be late. I'm going to be like, I have a test today in class.
And they were like, you're not going to class. You're going to prison. You just admitted to horrific crimes. And he's
like, what? Like, totally had, it was very sad.
Yeah.
Sarah, you should put that in the source notes.
Okay.
The clip you, or a clip.
Yeah. I'll find. Yep. I remember watching that, like, not quite understanding, like, how, but now it does make more sense. Like, if you do not fully understand what you are admitting to, you are stressed because this person of authority is asking something of you, telling you that you are lying. No matter how calmly they say it, they have authority over you, so you want to please them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said it earlier, too, Sarah. Could they find it without reasonable doubt? That's, like, that's what they take you to court for, is to try, like, is this person guilty without reasonable doubt that they did it? Well, it's almost the same thing when you're going through that interrogation process. Like, even a person who is 100% with it mentally, I mean, fuck, eventually if what you believe they say is true, they have this DNA of you being there and you can't think of how or when or why you were there, like, you do start bargaining and making those deals of like, okay, if I tell them I did it and I say, okay, well, if I admit to this, like, are you gonna, you know, do I only get, you know, probation? Like, what, what are we looking at here? Mm-hmm. Like, you, it's hard. It's very hard.
Yes. For my research, I loved a TED talk called Why Would You Confess to a Murder You Didn't Commit? I don't know who it's by. She does not say her name. It's not on the YouTube. But I will link it in our show notes.
Okay.
The biggest point she discusses, and the one that hits home for me, is the danger in implicitly trusting our criminal justice system. She uses an example of a police officer that comes in and bluffs, quote, we have the murder weapon and we're sending it to the lab now. We will find your prints. To a guilty person, terrifying. To an innocent person, what a relief. I can sign this confession now. Again, go pee, do whatever I have to do. And when those prints come back, they're going to see it's not me. And this has been all one big misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what really sucks.
Womp.
Yeah, because they're not sending that off for prints.
No. And you just signed.
You just signed.
The confession.
And walking back that confession is insanely difficult. The investigation is now not really as important. You have admitted to the crime. What else do they need?
Yep.
They don't, again, need to send that gun off for prints now. They have you. They have a signed confession from you. So you, as an innocent person trying to navigate an interrogation room, regardless of how intelligent you may feel or think you are always in a lot of danger of falsely confessing to a crime that you did not commit. As of right now, right under 95% of people in prison got there from a confession and a plea deal.
Wow.
Okay.
They may have done this for a less harsh sentence because they don't trust a trial. They might be doing it just to get out of the situation that I laid out before, or they do have that implicit trust that our system is going to correct itself.
Yeah. One of the videos I was watching, there was an officer or some guy who was like, everyone would like to think they wouldn't confess. Like, oh, I would never do that. Why would you ever confess? But just based off of the videos, like my case that I researched and everything, like I could see why it would be so easy to just be like, sure, I did it. Now, leave me alone.
Yes. Yeah. Because you're, again, 16 hours, dude, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm tapped.
Yeah. So out of those 95%, I wonder how many were falsely confessed and how many were true. But I think my co-hosts are going to drag us a little bit farther into that rabbit hole. So I will hand it over to you. I think, Morgan, you're first.
I am. Mine's a little bit different, but that's okay. We took it a different route because it's me. Of course I'm going to do something weird and different. But I did stumble upon this case, so I think it was quite interesting and a little bit different take on the false confession aspect.
Okay.
So, again, I think I tried looking this up, and it all references back that Anatomy of Murder episode that I watched. But, or watched, listened to. My lord,
Oh, it's fine. You watched with your ears.
I watched with my ears. My ears were on. this guy was, I'm trying to like think like how deep I want to go with this. Basically, he says he was gone at work all day, was supposed to have a date night with his wife. She never came home. And then finally at midnight, after he had fallen asleep for 2 hours, he was like, huh, the closet door's closed. She never closes the closet door. And her body was in there.
Oh.
So like they were like, you were home after work for hours and you walked past the closet to do laundry and you never noticed it until you woke up 7 hours after you were home. Like, just very weird. And the guy happens to be very monotone, very dry, isn't showing a lot of emotion that, like, mm-hmm. your girlfriend is dead, dude. Like, what the fuck?
To be fair, Clave and I don't share a closet. Mm-hmm. If his closet door was slid open or closed, I don't think I would immediately notice that. Like, no. I know he normally leaves them open, but if they were closed, I would just like, oh, he closed it today.
Yeah. Right. But that was like his big thing of that's how he stumbled upon her. Was like, I knew they weren't supposed to be closed. So it's like, then why didn't you see it when you got home and when you did laundry? Weird. So it's just very odd. Overall, they talk about and maybe this is just like a term that that particular cop used, but he said a dream vision confession. And I tried looking it up.
Oh, what is this?
And I tried looking it up, and all that the internet brought up was like, if you have dreams about Jesus and needing to confess your sins. And I was like, no. So I typed in like dream vision confession true crime. Still didn't come up. So I was like, God damn it. So
just like pseudoscience.
I think it's like a pseudoscience thing of,
like, this thing really doesn't exist, and they just made it up. Yeah,
exactly. It really didn't exist at all, and they made it up. Like, it was crazy. So I will...
I think he went on a vision quest over the weekend, because that is not a normal term.
So I will say... let me find it here. Anatomy of Murder, where are you? On Spotify. Okay, here we go. It is the episode... Oh my God, I've been saying Anatomy of Murder this whole fucking time. It was Dateline. God damn it.
Don't get them twisted.
Don't get it twisted.
Don't falsely confess to watching one show over the other. Watching with thy ears.
Yeah, because it's, and I remembered because the title of the Dateline episode is Behind the Closet Door. So, anyway, it's Dateline. So sorry. Scratch all of that. Also, Anatomy of Murder is a good podcast. You should also listen to it. Anyway, it's the episode that came out on June 27th of this year, and her name is Andrea Sincata. I'm so sorry, I don't remember how to pronounce it, but listen to that episode because I think it's a good spinoff of this topic today. But for my case today, I am taking you to the Netherlands. I was actually looking around trying to find a case, and guess who came in clutch for me again? TikTok, baby!
TikTok.
The link to that video where her case was mentioned will be in the show notes. While the quick segment on her told the whole story, I wanted to give you more background on Nicole and the case. So today I'm covering Nicole Van Den Herk. It's all three words. Van Den Herk.
Okay.
Okay.
Very Dutch.
Yeah. Very, coming from German, and then married a Scot, Swedish person.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, her stepdad. So her mom did. So. What made this even wilder when I started researching this case, her birthday, 43 years ago, on the day we're recording this, whoa. July 4th, 1980.
Whoa.
Okay, right? Okay. I was like, whoa, that's serendipitous stuff. So,
a story meant to be told.
Mm-hmm, yes. So, Nicole's mother was a single mother for a while, but after I think she was pretty young, got married to Nicole's stepfather. Nicole's mother did not win the custody battle of her in the 1989 divorce of Nicole's stepfather and her mother. And I was like, that's wild, right? Like, yeah. A stepfather who of a 9-year-old gets full custody.
That is very strange.
Very. But like, it sounds like her mom was maybe not the best. Her young life was very hard to find a lot of details on.
Okay.
Sadly, though, by 1995, Nicole's family's would face two tragedies. In April of that year, Nicole's mother unalived herself, And just 6 short months later, on October 6th, Nicole would go missing. Oh. So she's 15 at this point. AllThatIsInteresting.com said, quote, she left her grandmother's home in the early morning to bike to her job at a nearby shopping center, but never arrived, end quote. Thankfully, unlike most cases, the police did immediately start searching for her. By the end of that day, they had found her bicycle in a river. Again, All That Interesting states, quote, next clue didn't appear until October 19th, when her backpack was found in the Indenhoven Canal. Police continued to search the river, canal, and nearby forests multiple times over the next 3 weeks, but to no avail, end quote. Then, sadly, after a total of 7 weeks since the day she was reported missing, on November 22nd, Nicole's body was found. It was located very close to her grandmother's house and was found by luck of someone walking in a nearby park.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah. Even though several weeks had gone by, they were able to determine, trigger warning, that she had been raped and the cause of death was from a stab wound.
Oh.
While they had their list of possible subjects, from an issue with friends to even arresting Nicole's stepfather and stepbrother, however, quote, no evidence that linked them to the crime was ever found. Both were released and ultimately cleared of all involvement, end quote.
Okay.
While there were brief rumblings of the case being reopened and investigated in 2004, the case was ultimately cold until 2011. Yes, 16 years after her disappearance with little progress, Nicole's stepbrother did the unthinkable. He confessed to killing his stepsister.
Oh.
While it was tragic to hear this, at the same time, those who love Nicole hopes it would finally give them the closure that they so desired.
Yeah.
The crazy thing? It would give them that closure, but in the least likely way possible, a roller coaster from the start. The only way I can explain this is to quote, again, allthingsthatareinteresting.com, they just wrote the best article that I read on it. This is a quote from her brother. I wanted to get her exhumed and get DNA off her. I kind of set myself up, and it could have gone horribly wrong. To get her exhumed, I would have had to put steps in place to do that. I went to the police and said it. She is my sister, absolutely, and I miss her every day, end quote. What? If you're not following, Andy, Nicole's stepbrother, falsely confessed to his sister's murder just to get her body exhumed.
But
they wouldn't do that No, they refused to exhume it?
They refused.
Whoa.
Maybe I missed it. Why is he want her exhumed?
So that they can do DNA testing, because it happened in 1995.
Oh.
So 16 years later, he's like, there's got to be better tests that can be done. Bold. There's got to be something.
Strategy. So if he confesses, then they have to get DNA to see if it's his.
Do they have to get DNA?
I think they have to have it without reasonable doubt, or just to see. I mean, again.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I would still say everything would be circumstantial. So even if he were to go to trial, I don't know if they would.
Also, again, could have gone a lot harder in this. But again, we are in the Netherlands. So like rules are different.
Right.
But yes, again, so Andy, Nicole's stepbrother, had falsely confessed to killing her just to get the case reopened.
Wow.
I love you guys, but I don't know if I want to do that.
Yeah. It turns out, though, that this is exactly what the case needed. After 5 days in custody, Andy had done exactly what he set out to do, to get new air into the case and exhume Nicole's body. Depending on the source, between 2 to 3 men's profiles were picked up from testing. Her stepbrother himself, her boyfriend at the time, and a male not related to her. A former psych patient and convicted rapist, and again, I'm so sorry for mispronouncing the names, but also I don't really give a fuck about this guy. Jos DeG. So it's literally J-O-S space D-E space the letter G.
To your point, I don't care.
Don't care. Like, we'll just call him G because I don't give a fuck. Now, after reading what happened with the trials, I kept trying to put a spin on how to word the conviction that they landed on, and I can't. So again, to end my story here, I will end on a quote of, again, allthatisinteresting.com. Now, after reading what happened in the trial and everything that way, I kept trying to spin on how to word the conviction, and I couldn't. So again, to end it, on allthatisinteresting.com's quote, after 21 years of on and off investigation and almost 2 years in court, G was acquitted of the murder charge on November 21st, 2016. And instead, G was found guilty of rape and sentenced to 5 years in prison.
What?
Whoa.
End That's... quote.
But why?
Because they had no... Okay, so again, rules in the Netherlands are different. There was nothing pointing that they couldn't say that G and her had consensual sex before it happened. And the fact that there was other male profiles found, they couldn't definitively say that he was the one that killed her.
Okay.
Again, there was a lot more up and down all around. I would gladly recommend that you read the sources, read the entire article from All That's Interesting. The Wikipedia page goes deeper into like what happened during the first 2 years of the trial versus when they finally convicted him. But they were going for murder and rape, landed on only rape.
Okay.
And served 5 years. And I tried to do a little quick check on where he is. Couldn't find anything on Wikipedia of just him. And it just kept bringing up like her murder case. So I don't know where this motherfucker is. I'm kind of scared to look.
Maybe he's dead.
I hope he's dead. So
he ran into my knife. He ran into my knife 10 times.
Yes, Sarah. Yes. So again, I know that one is a little bit off kilter of more of what you were saying, Sarah, and I assume of what more, Aaron, your case is like, but
I think
it's false confessions for a positive effect.
It's a great take. I mean, I'm mad that guy only got 5 years, but also I'm wondering, in America, do we give like crazy harsh sentences compared to the rest of the world?
I'm sorry, Brock Turner, what?
You're right. Thank you for that correction. I need to back up.
I mean, oh, excuse me, he's going by his middle name now, Paul or some shit. Yeah, so still whatever Turner is his name, so...
I mean, with a face like that. In my head, I was hoping he was in and out of like a psych ward. So maybe like you go to prison and then you get in a bus back to the psych ward.
Yep. No. So, yeah. Mm. It was...
Cool
it was,
story, weird ending.
Thank you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely
cool
more...
Cool story, not great ending.
Yeah.
But could have been worse for the brother and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
What a risky move by the brother.
So fucking risky.
Yeah.
And again, I skimmed over some stuff. I don't know if they like charged him with false... statements or anything like that, but
Zach, my brother, if you're listening, I have high expectations now. If anything should happen to me,
pulling Andy,
yep.
Come on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my different kind of example. Aaron, I hear you have a doozy for us.
It is a doozy. Yes.
On this, the day of our country's birth.
Yes.
Okay.
What better time than now? So I will be covering the story of Michael Crow. So this takes place January 21st, 1998 in Escondido, California. Judith Kennedy wakes up at 6:30 a.m. to the sound of her granddaughter's 12-year-old Stephanie Ann's alarm clock. When there seems to be no end to the incessant beeping, she decides to check on her granddaughter. Instead of finding Stephanie fast asleep, Judith makes a horrifying discovery. Stephanie is lying motionless on her bedroom floor in a pool of blood.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Judith screams, wake up Stephanie's parents, Stephen and Cheryl Crow. The Crows.
Cheryl Crow? No yes. way. Come on now.
There's got to be one positive in this story.
Sheesh.
The Crows immediately contact the Escondido, California Police Department, who on arrival conduct a search of the property. According to CrimeWire, detectives didn't identify any signs of forced entry. They did note there were a few sliding glass doors that had been left unlocked, but were covered by what they described as heavy aluminum blinds. Basically, they didn't think someone would have been able to get inside the home through those doors undetected.
Okay, like it would have made a lot of noise.
Yeah, that's what I guess.
Okay.
Blinds
are pretty light, but all right.
I know. They said these were heavy, so I don't know what kind of blinds they had, but
it's just nice.
I'm going off of what
taped
they said.
To the window.
They're actually wind chimes.
Yeah. They definitely didn't get in here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Detectives come to the conclusion that one of the family members must have obtained a knife and stabbed Stephanie 8 times sometime between 9 p.m. late Tuesday night and early that morning while the rest of the family slept. Bruh. However, the murder weapon was nowhere to be found. And as of today, it's still never been found.
Okay.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. Stephen and Cheryl, along with their children, 14-year-old Michael and 9-year-old Shannon and Judith, are escorted to the police department to give individual statements and hand over their clothes for analysis. What detectives don't mention to the grieving family is that they already have an idea of who their prime suspect is. When they inspected Stephanie's body, they discovered hairs tangled on a ring she was wearing that seemed to be an ideal match to Michael. The teenager also acted, quote-unquote, distant and preoccupied during the discovery of his sister's body and the police investigation. And while detectives were searching the home, some noticed that Michael was sitting on the couch playing a video game. I saw this in one
source. How old is
source.
He?
14.
Okay. I know. All he's of me 14. Is like, he's traumatized and in shock, and I bet that video game brought him 2 seconds of, like, getting out of reality. This actually makes a lot of sense.
Some sort of
also,
comfort.
He's a 14-year-old fucking boy. Like,
yeah,
come on.
I would make a terrible police officer. My investigations would go nowhere.
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, no, you swear.
Makes perfect sense.
Michael also had possession of Dungeons and Dragons material, Motley Crue merchandise, and other heavy metal paraphernalia.
It must be him, Michael.
Heavy metal paraphernalia?
Yeah.
I'm dying. That's so funny.
I also only found this in, like, one source, too. But police allegedly discovered the word kill etched in pencil onto a windowsill. Didn't mention what room, so I don't know if it was his room, somewhere else.
You know
what? I don't know.
I bet his character in Dungeons and Dragons also kills. He's out of control. Mm-hmm. It was only a matter of time until he did it in this life.
He's yeah.
Wow.
Book him.
Right there, right now.
Don't even interrogate. We know he did it.
Yeah, that's it.
At the station, detectives proceed to separate the Crowe family, which Stephen initially opposes. He told Crime Stories that detectives promised him his children wouldn't be separated from them and that they would be with Cheryl or Judith. He eventually goes along with it when detectives assure him that this is typical procedure.
Okay.
Detectives, yet again, aren't being fully honest with the parents. Michael and Shannon will be interviewed one-on-one, but they will first be escorted to a county children's shelter until detectives are prepared to speak to them.
Whoa.
Yeah, so they're really dividing up the family.
Great.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. I don't love
it. Hey, your kid's
it.
Dead. I'm going to go ahead and separate the rest of you. Thanks.
Yeah.
This is where it always, like, no, I make a terrible cop. So I get why you would do this, but also, like, he could be innocent, and now you're just really lumping on the trauma.
They all
there.
Could be. Like, I get you got to act fast. Totally get that. But, like, could we act fast in, like, 7 directions instead of 2?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yay. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't love it.
Like, also, if he's guilty today, he'll also be guilty in 2 days. And his sister probably needed a friend. And
you
she's
right.
not guilty at all.
Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Stephen and Cheryl are allowed to leave the station at 10 p.m. after intense questioning. Unbeknownst to them, Michael is brought to the station and sat down in front of detectives, who basically tell him he's guilty. Besides divulging the quote-unquote evidence they had gathered from the home, detectives also tell Michael that they had found blood in his bedroom. This is complete bullshit. And it wasn't the only false information detectives tell Michael. According to Wikipedia, detectives also told him that his parents even thought he was the killer.
Oh, no.
It's really bad.
Again, do you have to lump on the drama?
Like, let's physically and mentally isolate you from your parents.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I haven't mentioned this, but Michael doesn't have a lawyer present.
Cool.
Detectives read him his Miranda rights and asked if he understood. And, like, he did just say, you know, yes. That's when they started grilling him. So, which by law in California they can do. So detectives can question minors without their parental consent. An interrogation must end if the minor requests to have their parent or guardian present. So I was reading this on this website, shouselaw.com, that the request to, like, see a parent has to be, like, very specific. So cops can kind of get away with not having a parent present. So
to say, like, I wish to see thy father.
Yeah.
Insert first, middle, last name, date of birth, last four social. Like, how,
like,
specific?
What the fuck?
The website gave this scenario where, like, a 6-year-old kid is being questioned and he asked detectives if he can call his mother. The detectives say they are happy to let him talk to her if he tells them all of the information he knows.
Oh,
after an hour, this kid confesses to the crime. So in this situation, the website mentioned how the child's rights may not have been violated because he didn't specify why he wanted to call his mom. So if he would have mentioned calling his parent to get a lawyer, or if he would have told detectives that he was just going to remain silent, then detectives would have had to honor his Miranda rights and cease all questioning. So it's very gross. It's very slimy.
Yeah.
How they can get away with this. Because in these videos, and I will post a link where you can, like, watch all the videos on this website, like, he mentions, like, wanting his parents or seeing his parents. So I don't know how I don't believe I watched the entire – I didn't watch the entire interrogation video. But – so I don't know how specific he was when he was telling detectives this. But he didn't get to see his parents.
That's sad.
Very sad. During his interrogation, Michael is also administered a voice stress analysis test, which is less reliable than a coin flip in determining whether someone is being honest.
I've never heard of this test.
It's basically pseudoscience. It's not legit at all.
For being a town thought of like voice actors, it does kind of make sense for like California. It's a voice detection test.
Yeah. Just more bullshit,
basically.
Later, when asked why he agreed to the test, Michael stated, quote, "I feel like I spent all day away from my family. I couldn't see them. I feel like I'm being treated like I killed my sister, and I didn't. It feels horrible, like I'm being blamed for it. Everything I own is gone. Everything I have is gone. Everything. You won't even let me see my parents. It's horrible," end quote.
And he's 14 and does not know his rights.
Correct.
All right, if you guys have kids, bring them over to Auntie Sarah's house. We're going to have a sit down to talk about the law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always ask for your parent directly.
Or a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
And again, even like this family is being interviewed in these videos I was watching. And even the mom is just like, we've taught our kids to, you know, respect the law and that they're here to, you know, help you and to help us.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's that implicit trust.
Yeah.
It's scary.
Yes.
Yeah, police are the good guys.
Mm-hmm.
In this
and again, dungeon? This kid probably doesn't see, like, one turn to the next turn to the next turn.
No.
Like, good sir, you're in a cul-de-sac. You're not getting out. They fenced it up.
Yep.
He, isn't seeing what's coming to him. The detective informs Michael of the test results. The test alleges Michael lied when he answered the question, "Do you know who took Stephanie's life?" As the questioning continues, one of the detectives in the room tells another detective within earshot of Michael that Michael is 100% guilty of murdering his sister.
Oh no.
When this detective leaves, Michael breaks down in tears. On the third day of questioning, the detectives try to get Michael to confess by having him write a letter to Stephanie. So having him write a letter to his dead sister.
The trauma.
Mm-hmm.
No.
That's so cruel.
Very cruel. Again.
It's disgusting.
Loading on all that trauma.
Are we allowed to sue police forces for therapy?
Yeah, dude.
Okay. I would hope. I would wish, but I don't know.
I'll look into that. Again, bring your kids over here. We're going to have a chat. Once a year on their birthday.
In this letter, Michael mentions that if he did kill Stephanie, then he had gone insane because he doesn't remember it. But the police are telling him that he did it. Detectives continue asking him the same questions, to which he says he doesn't know the answers to. At one point, Michael kind of snaps back at the detectives, stating, quote, "You keep asking me questions I can't answer. What do you want me to do? Make something up? Lie to you?" End quote.
Good this, yeah, that's good. That's something I would hope somebody would say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But at this point, it kind of goes back into that, like, oh, he's crying. He's guilty. That's how they're taking it. In this case. At this point, this kid is still crying. He is a mess. And the detectives just have no sympathy for him. Like, one detective even tells him to, like, cut it out. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that so sad?
That is so sad.
Yeah. Like I said, there will be a link that has all the videos if you want to watch them. But if you don't, I don't blame you. It's very upsetting.
There's no reason to be like that.
No. To make matters worse, Michael had come down with the flu, so he was sick for, like, the entire interrogation. So that did not help. And I couldn't find a consistent like timeline for the interrogation. So specifically, I was curious how many total hours Michael was interrogated for. So it was over the span of 3 days. The Crime Stories documentary on the case says 12 hours over 3 days, but Crime Wire claims he was interrogated for a total of 27 hours.
Holy fuck.
So I feel like those are very starkly different.
Very.
There's a limit to what they can do, right? Isn't it like they don't have a confession the first 3 days or something?
Something. I don't know. That's
something I should have looked up. Listeners, if you know, let us know. They can trade information that way. We're a community, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't find a specific answer, so.
I think there is some kind of limit.
Okay. Either or, he was interrogated for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Too long.
Too long.
Yes. Michael is at his breaking point, and detectives continue to present him with leading questions, such as, how was a knife used to kill someone? And Michael's response was, maybe stab them.
Very Brendan Dassey. Yep.
Mm-hmm. When detectives promise Michael he will be reunited with his family if he just admits to killing his sister, he reluctantly confesses, stating, quote, I'm only saying this because it's what you want to hear, end quote. Instead of joining his family at the station, Michael is placed under arrest and charged with Stephanie's murder. But that's not all. So Michael's friends, 15-year-old Aaron Hauser and 15-year-old Joshua David Treadway, who regularly played D&D with him and listened to the same bands, were also brought in for questioning. Aaron collected knives as a hobby, and one of them had reportedly gone missing. The missing knife was found with Joshua at his house, which he claimed to have just taken from Aaron. Detectives brought them in for questioning and asked them similar leading questions. They also prompted the boys to share their theories on how Stephanie was killed.
No.
Similar to Michael, Joshua was subjected to an overnight interrogation and then had to undergo another grueling 10-hour questioning 2 weeks later, where after being deprived of, you know, sleep, food, and opportunities to relieve himself, he confessed to murdering Stephanie with Michael and Aaron as accomplices. During questioning, Aaron didn't actually confess to the crime, so he just made like a hypothetical guess to what may have happened to Stephanie, which police just took as him admitting to the murder. Aaron and Joshua were also arrested for Stephanie's murder. Even though their confessions were filled with discrepancies, and officers had actually failed to administer Miranda rights to Joshua.
Ooh.
Or Aaron, it was one of them.
That's a big miss.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what?
Sorry, I'm like massaging my jaw. Sorry, that's a huge miss. Sorry, I've learned a trick on TikTok and I'm just sitting here
also
stressed.
How would those extra two boys even have been in the house?
I don't know.
Someone just let them in at the front door, right? Because they don't have to sneak in, they get let in.
Yeah.
Okay, answer my own question.
Again, someone that's
through those blinds. I'm telling you that.
Someone close to the family who would either already be in the house or know of the house and its layout.
Should we be playing D&D? Because if this is the kind of situation to get you in, I don't know if I'm ready for it.
I'm safe. Fuck you guys.
Did you hear Sarah plays D&D like all the time?
I know. It's all the time. I heard Sarah does.
Cops, close your ears.
Someone's listening. They tapped the phone.
I'm a healer, not a killer, okay? Sorry, go on, Aaron.
Michael, Aaron, and Joshua were held in a juvenile prison until their first preliminary hearing was held, where they were going to be tried as adults.
Oh my God!
Yes.
That's a big jump. Isn't he 14?
14, 15, 15. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
The boys' parents immediately obtained legal counsel for them and defended their sons to the public. So they had no doubt that their sons were innocent.
Right.
The two pals.
All the boys.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. At the hearing, all three boys' statements and videos of their interviews were accepted in court and heavily scrutinized due to the detective's use of the Reed technique. And I actually have, I just found it off of Wikipedia, so I listed out the steps to this technique.
Yeah.
That's the website I found that explained how to set up an interrogation room.
Yeah. So I can go over that if you guys want me to. So first they use more of a like positive confrontation. They advise the suspect that the evidence has led the police to them. And then they offer the suspect an early opportunity to explain like, hey, why did this happen? Mm-hmm. Why did this take place? Mm-hmm. The second step is trying to shift the blame away from the suspect to another person or another set of circumstances that may have prompted them to commit the crime. So they develop themes containing reasons that will psychologically justify or excuse the crime. And they could change these themes just to find one to which that accused person is like most responsive to. So they can introduce whatever they want at any point.
Okay.
The third step is try to minimize the frequency of suspected denials. So they want to make sure the person isn't denying them a whole bunch. Step four, the accused will often give a reason why he or she did not or could not commit the crime. So detectives will try to use this to move towards the acknowledgement of what they did, what they actually did in the situation.
What? So they leapfrog over your reasoning? Like, I hear you, but take that out and you could have done it.
Yeah. That's... Or like, okay, if you didn't do this, then what did you do?
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Mental somersault. I don't like it.
Yeah. Hey, they will continue to be sincere. At this point, the suspect usually becomes quieter and actually listens to the detectives more. This is the point when they start offering alternatives for, you know, oh, this could have happened or this could have happened. And then it says if the suspect cries at this point, then this infers guilt, that they're guilty.
No,
so
bro.
With Michael crying, they were like, oh, okay, this kid did it.
Oh, come on. I mean, I'm gonna cry at the drop of a hat, so fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'll find out real quick. I'm not emotionally strong.
Yes. Mm. Detectives will start posing the what's called the alternative question. So they really give like two choices for what happened. One that's like more socially acceptable than the other. And the suspect tends to choose the, I guess, easier option. And if granted, it's kind of a setup. So
yeah.
Technically you shouldn't choose any of them. Mm. But if the suspect does, or the one person being questioned does choose one, then that admits some sort of guilt or infers some guilt.
This is all terrifying because I see psychologically they're offering you like two exits on a highway and you think the highway is closed, but you can go around the signs. Like you could have went straight the whole time. Oh, that's so scary. Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
They then lead the suspect to kind of repeat their admission of guilt in front of witnesses and develop corroborating information to establish the validity of the confession. And then the last one, which really ties back with Michael and how they asked him to write a letter to his dead sister, they want to document the suspect's admission or confession and have him or her prepare a recorded statement. So whether that's audio, video, or written. So that technically, if they had him sign it at the end, could have been his confession.
Awesome.
Yeah. Written out. Oh, insane.
Oh, that's so sad and scary.
Yes. So going back, so that was just a retechnique. So you can kind of see all the different tactics used during Michael's questioning and Aaron's and Joshua's as well.
You can also see how trained these interrogators are.
Mm-hmm.
So again, no matter how intellectual you think you are, I promise you've not been studying of like how to combat an interrogation. Unless you have, write to us.
Yeah. Then let us know. I have to say this before I forget my train of thought, but like, I think it is pretty much bullshit that they can lie. I don't like, but I've heard a lot of interrogations on like shows or podcasts or anything like that. And I am more of a fan of when they say things like, give us a reason why your DNA would not be in blah blah's car or things like that. But for you to just lie and say we found it, I feel like that's fucked up.
Oh,
you're not allowed
to
lie on the stand. You're not allowed to lie. Like, how is that admissible?
Yeah.
And that's the shit that I don't like.
Wouldn't you want to find some sort of DNA to just have that actual physical credible evidence to tie someone to it? Like, that's what blows my mind is that you're going after this kid who didn't do it. Spoiler alert. And
what?
When you could have been going after the person who did do it the entire time.
If you had just done your job broadly.
But let's flip the devil's advocate. Or you have this prime suspect in front of you. It costs money to send out all those tests. It just costs you a few hours of interrogation if you can get him to tell the truth that you know to be the truth.
Yeah, if you know
that's...
it. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I've been reading a lot of like the police jargon. I'm like, I get where you are coming from, but I tend to agree with your side, Aaron, but
yeah.
There's yeah. Just that's why I said sides. They didn't need to do their job correctly, because they are doing their job correctly, but like, again, broad. Can we do what you're doing, but like to not just the immediate, right off the bat, who you think it could be?
Mm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
That's all.
So going back to Michael, Aaron, and Joshua, it wouldn't be until later that year in December when the boys' confessions were officially retracted due to police obtaining new evidence that pinned a different man to the scene of the crime. The day before Stephanie's murder, police received several reports of a man in the Crow's neighborhood acting strangely, peering into windows, knocking on doors, and screaming near homes, one of those homes being the Crow residence, while allegedly searching for an old girlfriend. That's why he was doing all this.
Okay.
28-year-old Richard Raymond Tuitt, a homeless man suffering from schizophrenia, was questioned about his whereabouts in the hours leading up to the crime. According to Mark Sauer's reporting for KPBS, police released Tuitt after questioning him for only 20 minutes, even though there were scrapes on his body and a noticeable cut on his hand. They had taken Tuitt's red sweatshirt and other garments into evidence, but the clothing was never tested since they were solely focused on Michael being the killer.
I'm out of here. I'm blasting off. Are you fucking kidding me?
DNA testing in February 1999 confirmed Tuitt's sweatshirt contained drops of Stephanie's blood. On May 15th, 2002, Tuitt was arrested for Stephanie Crow's murder, and on May 26th, 2004, the jury found Tuitt guilty of voluntary manslaughter, and he was sentenced to 13 years in prison.
Sheesh.
Four more years were tacked on to his sentence due to him escaping from his holding cell and leaving the courthouse, which resulted in, like, this huge manhunt.
Whoa. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, it was definitely the 14-year-old. Are you fucking kidding me? Look at this guy.
Yeah. 7 years into Tuitt's sentencing, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit overturned the ruling due to one witness, out of a slew of other witnesses, not being cross-examined by the defense. Tuitt was acquitted of all charges during his retrial in December 2013, and he was subsequently released from prison.
What?
No.
But at the same time, I don't know. It's hard to tell. Like, was Tuitt the guy who did it, or was it someone else?
But the blood.
Okay. So a lot of the evidence presented during Tuitt's trial was circumstantial, and that may have been what led to his acquittal. Tuitt had never been inside of the Crow home, so he wouldn't have had any knowledge of the layout. His DNA was never found in the home, and according to Wikipedia, an expert testified that Stephanie's blood wasn't originally on Tuitt's sweatshirt when it was first, like, looked at and evaluated. They claimed it had been contaminated during crime scene analysis.
Oh.
Yes.
I mean,
which I had read that they had...
things happened.
Yeah. I'd read that they had tested it once, and there was nothing, and then they sent it to a different lab, and then there was
that happened in the Stephen Avery case quite a bit as well.
It did. I'm sorry, but not knowing the layout of someone's home is not a fucking valid reason for a murder to not occur. Are you fucking kidding me? Well, call true. A robbery gone wrong. Do you think there are people who are just bust into your house to steal whatever they fucking can, and if you cross their path, they're gonna kill you? Like,
I think what they're saying, though, is they think Stephanie was specifically targeted, so they would have had to know her room. It wasn't like this person went around and just killed all of them, like you would think.
I mean,
was there not a window in her room?
I have no idea.
But if it's also, they said it happened in the middle of the night, what if they just, everyone was asleep and the guy had a fucking flashlight and said, that one looks good, and then did it?
That's total possibility.
Why are, I feel like they're so fucking one-sided with this. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm getting really upset.
Yeah. I think it's just the fact that they don't have that clear
broaden
DNA
your
evidence.
Horizons. Broaden your Okay. Sorry. I'm not doing good.
You're good. I'm fine. The urge to do devil's advocate, but...
That's okay.
Because flip side, that guy also deserves justice. Let's say this was another bungle, like...
Yeah, yeah. If the blood thing was not real, okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. Great.
But you're arguing about the house layout. I can see it's not one you should really...
That's not letting somebody off scot-free.
Nah, that's not concrete.
Yeah. In more recent news, Tuitt was arrested in 2021 on a drug possession charge. I am not sure if he is still in prison, but, I mean, this guy has a rap sheet. He hasn't been arrested for murder besides this time, so I don't know. It definitely wasn't Michael. Definitely wasn't him. Was it this guy? Maybe more likely, but I still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have yet to be on jury duty, so I feel like
I can't wait.
I don't know. I compare it to, like, if detectives can put some away so easily, but knowing myself, I cannot. Like, you, yes. That person's fate is in your hands, and you have to come to a decision. Freaks me out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big responsibility.
Yeah.
That's why you would hope, if you are on a jury, that you do get a bunch of non-circumstantial evidence. So it's clear as day, this is what happened. But that's not likely, because if there is that clear non-circumstantial evidence, then your lawyer will say, hey, this ain't looking good, kid.
Yeah.
Why don't you take a plea deal?
And exactly.
They wouldn't probably even see it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, my God. Oh, my God.
False confession expert Richard Leo watched Michael's, Aaron's, and Joshua's interrogation videos and determined that all three boys were coerced. Mm-hmm. According to InjusticeAnywhere.net, Leo compared the questionings to psychological torture. In order to make the interrogation stop, the boys told the detectives everything they wanted to hear. This is the website that also has the Crime Stories documentary videos I watched, so I will have that linked in the show notes for anyone interested. The Crow family filed a civil suit against Escondido police and county prosecutors for violating Michael's rights against false arrest and imprisonment. In November 2011, the Crows accepted a $7.25 million settlement. And I also think the family was wanting that police department, or at least the specific detectives involved, to receive some sort of, like, consequences. But they, quote, came to realize that the police would never admit they were wrong, end quote. So I feel like it is difficult to probably sue a police department in that case. But they did get a settlement out of it. So hopefully they were able to use that for some therapy for Michael.
Or tons, tons and tons.
Tons and tons. A year later, in a rare ruling, Superior Court Judge Kenneth So declared Michael, Aaron, and Joshua factually innocent of Stephanie's murder. The judge ordered the men's arrest and prosecution records to be destroyed without delay.
Love that.
So, yes. Yeah. So a little bit of a bright side there. As of today, Stephanie's murder remains unsolved. The FBI's behavioral analysis unit believes Stephanie's killer was extremely organized and thorough. The killer was able to enter the house without being detected and left the scene without leaving any DNA or other evidence behind. The stab wounds appeared methodical, and the FBI didn't believe the killing was random. FBI crime scene analyst Mary Ellen O'Toole took the stand at Tuitt's trial, where she stated the killer was someone who is familiar with the layout of the Crow's home and may possibly have been familiar with the family as well. And that is the story of Michael Crow and his false confession.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Wow.
Insane story.
Both brothers. That's weird.
I know that is. Yeah.
We didn't even plan that.
Well, brother, wow. I'm scared to go into an interrogation room.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I need my
that
lawyer.
Freak
I need
you
my
out.
Lawyer. I need my lawyer. That's all you just say that. Triple time. Like Beetlejuice. Yes. Lawyer, lawyer, lawyer.
Well, hopefully, I don't know if this gets some good discussion going for people,
because
I wouldn't really know what to do in an interrogation room either. Mm-hmm. So
maybe in the future I'll cover, like, how should you act in an interrogation room? I bet it's something simple, like you just ask for a lawyer.
Yeah, I think that's basically all you have to do. Ask for a lawyer, say you're going to remain silent, and then they have to, like, leave you alone.
I think what sucks is the good human in you probably wants to help with the case if you have any information. So you have to, like...
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they twist it around too, like, oh, you're asking for a lawyer because you're guilty.
Oh, type of absolutely.
Thing. Mm-hmm.
People can be innocent all the time. I mean, you can never do anything right when you're, you know.
Also, a lawyer costs money. You know, you're sitting there like,
yeah,
I have some ideas. I don't want to ask for a lawyer. That's going to be expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's all tough.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, sorry to end it on a downer, guys.
Thanks to all of us. That was swell.
Yes.
Totally.
Here, I say here. Freely in my dining room.
Well, when this comes out, it will have been the 4th, so happy Independence Day to all of our listeners. We hope you keep listening. And if you have any suggestions for individual or group topic ideas, send them over to sinistersunrisepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what you hear, we would love to see some rating and reviews from you listeners. You can do that on Apple Podcasts or even on Spotify. Give us a follow, and we hope to see you next time. See you next week, everybody.
Stay sinister.
Bye.
Bye.